Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To The Point. Today, we'll hear why the letters PG and E don't just stand for Pacific Gas and Electric anymore, but Pray to God and Evacuate. We'll hear the history of America's largest utility, a corporate criminal, after deadly fires that caused billions in damage, creating a precarious future for Northern California. First, though, it's national politics. This year's midterm elections are almost upon us. Will Democrats or Republicans control the Congress and Senate? Will there be a split decision? Whatever the outcome, it'll be a preview of the presidential election in 2024, and no current politician will matter more to the future than our past president, Donald Trump. Susan Glasser is with us. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and co-author of an exhaustive account of Trump's 4 years in office. Her co-author is her husband, Peter Baker, of The New York Times. The book is called The Divider. And Susan, it's great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You can count the ways that Trump has been divisive in this book, almost 800 pages long. It seems never to get dull. You say at the end that there's no such thing as a post-Trump America. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Warren. It's great to be with you. The truth is we set out to write a history, a first crack at a real full four-year history of Trump in the White House and his presidency. And in the 18 months or so since Trump has left office, it's become clear that, you know, the story of his presidency is not yet in the past. It's really in some ways potentially prologue, as Trump seems to be on a path to try to seek to become the only president in American history, aside from Grover Cleveland, to be defeated and win his way back to the White House. And it's very much the ongoing present tense, at a minimum, of American politics, even if it's not definitely our future, you know?
So you're almost making a flat-out prediction that he's going to run again.
Well, he's given many indications of wanting to run again. It seems that he was prepared perhaps to do so earlier this summer when the sort of metastasizing investigations caught up with him, including the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago that turned up all those classified documents that he had taken with him from the White House. And so, you know, we'll see. I think we'll know pretty soon after the midterm elections coming up in less than 6 weeks whether that is in fact the case. But even if it's not, Trump has remade the Republican Party, no doubt, in his image. And I think Trumpism will outlast Trump, regardless of whether he's a candidate for 2024 or not.
Would running for office give him a kind of protection, or at least a sort of delaying action against all of those metastasizing investigations you mentioned?
Yeah, I think that that's one reason Trump may be so seriously considering running again, is a belief that it offers a certain amount of protection to him, that the Justice Department would be less likely to pursue an active presidential candidate. And he may or may not be correct about that as a matter of law, but it does seem to be factoring into Trump's thinking.
Not just law, but politics. Wouldn't the Justice Department be likely to step back, at least for the moment, if in fact he were a candidate?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Trump is a master at politicizing institutions that have striven, not always successfully, but have certainly striven to stay out of the day-to-day fray of electoral politics, like the Justice Department, like the military. That's in many ways what set us on the course to try to write The Divider, was to understand how Trump's playbook has been used by him over time to take on many of the core institutions of our American democracy. And the Justice Department is one. You know, he was very clear from the beginning of his presidency, which he came into office under investigation. Now, 2 years after leaving, he's under investigation again. And he's used the same playbook, whatever the substance of the investigation. He will attack the investigators. He will undermine them individually and collectively as an institution, say that it's all politics, and certainly he'd be aided in doing so as an active presidential candidate.
You conducted hundreds of interviews in order to do this book. As I said, it's almost 800 pages long. Two of the interviews were with Trump himself, and in the second interview, he actually lied about what he told you in the first interview. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a classic Trump performance. I should say, by the way, my husband hates that 800-page number. You know, that includes extensive endnotes, which we put in there because we wanted to be a first crack at a real history of Trump in the White House.
I didn't mean to make it sound boring. It's just, that's a measure of how extensive it is.
No, and you know, we wanted it to be, you know, a first crack at the history. But I should point out that these interviews were all conducted, the original interviews, after Trump left office. And our effort was to go back and to understand better what had played out over the 4 years, as well as to find out new things that we didn't know anything about. And, you know, I think that's important to note, you know, that this is all stuff that we found out, the new revelations after Trump left office. We did also go to visit Trump twice in Mar-a-Lago, as you point out. You know, that was quite an experience. Clearly, Trump, not a big reader of my New Yorker column, but, he just remained supremely confident in his ability to persuade or to convince almost anyone. But, you know, yeah, basically in the spring of 2021, we went to see him not that long after the vaccine had come out. Trump himself, a big believer in the vaccine, had taken it, although he hadn't publicly promoted that. But it was already clear that many of his supporters were anti-vaccine. And he told us then, when we asked, that the Biden administration had actually reached out to him and asked him to cut a public service announcement that would try to reach some of those vaccine hesitant Trump voters. And he told us that he was considering it. Well, flash forward 7 months later, we go to visit Trump again. We're just sort of chit-chatting at the beginning of the interview. And we said, hey, whatever happened to that public service announcement? It never appeared. And he said, what are you talking about? There is no such thing. No one ever asked me to do that. We said, well, wait a minute. You know, you told us that the Biden administration asked you to do it. No, I didn't. Where did you get that? Where did you get that? You told us that. You told us that. And it was a vintage Trump performance. You know, was he lying to us the first time or the second time? You know, you never really know with him.
Well, so what does that tell us then about what's likely in a Trump campaign? And how would you describe a potential Trump campaign based on the history of the administration and, of course, the most recent campaign?
Well, I do think, you know, one of the reasons that Trump was not eager to promote the vaccine is that in the intervening few months, he had actually mentioned his support for the vaccine in a rally in Alabama of his supporters, and they booed him. And this is a very unusual thing at a Trump rally for them to boo their leader. And it's a reminder that Trump is both, you know, sort of the figurehead of the Trump movement, but he is also at times following what he perceives to be his core fans. And he's, you know, the architect of Trumpism, but also at times a hostage to it. And I think you see that in some of his recent appearances where he has gone down the road of outright embracing the QAnon conspiracy theory. In 2020, he flirted with QAnon and he was asked about it one of the debates. He said, well, I don't know anything about it, but you know, they support me, they like me. Now he's actually playing their anthem at his rally. He has sent out on his social media platform an image of himself with the Q icon emblem photoshopped onto him. And you know, I think that's kind of what you would see in a Trump 2024 candidacy, is a more extreme version of the Trump that you saw in 2020 and 2016, as he follows in an ever escalating spiral to keep his fans entertained and enraged and, you know, locked on to him. And that's the story of the 4 years of the Trump administration that we saw very clearly in the book.
For any campaign, one of the important things is the staff that is assembled to run it. It's not an easy thing to do, especially if you're campaigning in all 50 states. One of your chapters is called Team of Amateurs, and that refers to the people that he had around him in the administration itself, and of course in the aftermath after January 6th, particularly, and leading right up to January 6th. So who would he get, do you think, to help him run his campaign?
Well, that is actually a very good question, because, you know, one of the notable things about Trump in the presidency was he didn't expect to win, number one, back in 2016. So he didn't take the prospect and the prospect of a transition to the government seriously. Number two, he is perhaps the most inexperienced president of modern history when he came to office, and in fact, the only president never to have served a single day in government or in the military before becoming the president. He did not have a cadre of loyal aides, advisors, and officials to surround him in politics and government. And he ended up hiring many people in a very haphazard way. One of the things that we heard again and again and again about his hiring, especially at the beginning of the administration, was he would literally look at somebody and say, wow, he really looks like he's from Central Casting. He fits the suit. He plays the part. And obviously that can be a risky way to staff your government. But over the 4 years that Trump was in the White House, he certainly adapted, and personal loyalty became one of his main criterion for who he wanted surrounding him. And with all that enormous turnover over time, you start out with advisors like Jim Mattis and John Kelly, very respected retired four-star Marine generals, and you end up with people like Mark Meadows as the final chief of staff, a very hard right congressman from leader of the Freedom Caucus, who, as one official characterized him, you know, was essentially a matador for bringing in conspiracy theorists into the Oval Office after the 2020 election. You know, the kind of thing that John Kelly, when he was chief of staff, you know, probably would have thrown himself in front of the door of the Oval Office rather than let people in who were openly talking to the president about imposing martial law in order to overturn the results of the election. So that's the kind of thing in a Trump second term you could expect more of.
In the book, you talk about people, particularly at the end of the administration and especially after January 6th, who really thought that Trump should have been removed from office. And that includes, according to your book, a lot of Republicans, but they're not named. They're not speaking out. Some of them are, obviously. We have two of them on the January 6th committee, but others aren't speaking out and aren't being heard from. Do you think it's likely that if he runs again, some of those people, including some who thought he was crazy, and you quote them as saying that, would they speak out, do you think? Or would they, like Mitch McConnell, who denounced him in the Senate itself, but refused to vote for his impeachment, and now says, oh, if he ran again, I would support him completely. Is that the pattern that you would expect from other Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, look, that has been the story of Trump's entire time in public life, is Republicans privately groaning about him, complaining about him, opposing him, and nonetheless acceding to his hostile takeover of their party. And this is a remarkable shift and really a radicalization of the Republican Party. And I think that, you know, critics of Trump, Democrats and other critics, Republican critics of Trump, sort of waited throughout the 4 years of the Trump presidency as if there was going to be this sort of singular accountability moment, a moment also when, you know, the Republicans on Capitol Hill would finally make the jailbreak. That was the joke in Washington. When is the jailbreak going to happen? Well, January 6th was the ultimate opportunity for them to make that jailbreak, and they chose not to. In fact, I always come back to, some people date this, you know, the kind of return to Trump to when Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, flew down to Mar-a-Lago just a couple weeks after January 6th and basically kissed the ring of Donald Trump. But, you know, to me, you didn't even need to look any further than later that night of January 6th when the House and Senate came back into session and 147 Republican House members and senators, two-thirds of the House Republican Conference, went ahead and voted against certifying Joe Biden's lawful election following Trump, even as they walked over the shattered glass of the United States Capitol. So, you know, I don't think they're about to make a jailbreak now.
Kevin McCarthy, of course, significant because he too denounced the president, or said he held him responsible for the assault on the Capitol initially, and then, as you said, showed up at Mar-a-Lago and has been very supportive of the lie about the Biden victory ever since. What about some of the major issues that we're dealing with, particularly internationally, and Trump's relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine? That's going to be, no doubt, very much on the front burner during the campaign for the presidency next time around. What would you expect from him there?
Yeah, I mean, look, the enduring mystery of Trump's sort of sycophancy and admiration of one of America's chief adversaries, Vladimir Putin, is an extraordinary way in which Trump was different than any other president of the United States. And Trump has continued that when he's been out of office. In fact, it's very clear that if he were to run again for president and win, that he would not be a staunch supporter of the billions of dollars in military aid that the United States, largely through bipartisan votes, has been sending to Ukraine to stop the Russian invasion of their country. And, you know, Trump remains the leader of a small but growing and significant faction of basically pro-Putin Republicans in the House of Representatives and in the conservative media, who have continued to make excuses for Putin's invasion and to question the need for the American commitment to Ukraine. So it's a major differential between Trump and not only the Democrats, but a large chunk of his own party. And yet many in his party have been willing to follow him anyways, despite his disturbing record of praise for a leader of Russia who would launch such a bloody, horrific, and unprovoked war.
You talked about the conservative media. What about Fox News? How important was it to the Trump administration? How important might it be to a Trump campaign for the presidency?
Yeah, one of the things that was really striking to me in going back and re-reporting sort of the Trump years was how much Trump defined his job in a way unlike that of any other president. He basically didn't want to have meetings, didn't want to have a traditional schedule. He came into the Oval Office much later than other presidents did. He blew up the schedule, and he took the private dining room next to the Oval Office, and he basically turned that into his own private media bunker. He spent large chunks of the day every day, up to 4 to 6 hours a day, according to advisors, in that private dining room, watching television, much of it Fox News, and then tweeting in response to it. One White House official told me that he defined the job of being president of the United States kind of like Mike TV, the little boy in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, who sits there watching television all day long and asks Willy Wonka to transport him inside the TV. And that feedback loop between Fox and Twitter. And, you know, he would call up the hosts after they had appeared and give them sort of an after action report. He would take advice on important policy and political and personnel questions from people like Sean Hannity. And, you know, it was just a remarkable synergy between a president and a network that we've never seen before.
What about Governor DeSantis? It appears that he is likely to run, or he's certainly separating himself from Donald Trump in every way that he possibly can. Does that seem to bother Trump?
Of course it does. You know, you've already seen some rumblings from Trump. Hey, I made Ron DeSantis. He wouldn't be nothing without me. And actually, Trump has a certain case there. Back in the 2018 gubernatorial primary, DeSantis at the time was a very conservative House member from Florida, and he was running in a contested primary in which he staked out a position as the most pro-Trump of the candidates. There was one television commercial that DeSantis ran in which he dressed his little infant child in a Make America Great Again onesie, and the rest of the commercial was him reading a book to his toddler daughter, How to Build the Wall. And so, you know, he really basically was elect me, I'm for Trump, even though, of course, that doesn't really tell people whether you're qualified to be the governor of a state. And so there is this resentment. And as we all know, Trump is not exactly psychologically wired to leave the stage gracefully. It's hard to imagine him bowing out in favor of a successor, especially one who has ridden his coattails, as Trump sees it.
You said a moment ago, and you say in the book, that Trump's administration was sort of an assault on the various institutions of government. So what is the purpose of a Trump presidency? Does he have some sort of basic raison d'etre for being president of the United States and being in charge of the government?
Yeah, I think that's an important and interesting question. Trump's agenda, as far as we could tell, was the same as it was in his business life for decades before. It was about promoting Donald Trump. He originally ran for president, telling advisors that it would be the ultimate kind of brand promotion exercise and good for the Trump organization and good for Trump personally. He, as ideologically speaking, has been a very chameleon-like character. He was a member at different points of five different political parties, switching back and forth between the Democratic and Republican Party, even running briefly at one point on the Reform Party ballot unsuccessfully. He was pro-choice until he was anti-abortion. He was pro-gun rights until he was anti-gun until he was pro-gun and the like. You know, he's shown a great willingness to jettison positions at will, a very transactional view of most ideological questions in order to gain support as he has entered politics. And so, you know, it wasn't so much about an agenda, I think, for Donald Trump as it was about what he wanted to be. And he wanted to be the president.
We could go on for a very long time. You are a encyclopedia of information about Donald Trump, and it's very interesting to hear you predict what might happen. I'm interested in how you and Peter Baker managed to conduct all of these interviews, hundreds of them, just since the Trump presidency came to an end. How do you do it? Do you do the interviews together? Do you assign them to other people? Do you have a staff that you work with? How does it come together?
just me and Peter here in the home front, and you know, some wonderful young folks who helped us by fact checking the book. But you know, we did some important interviews together, like the Trump interviews in Mar-a-Lago. But basically, we came up with an outline for the book, and we divided up the chapters 50-50. And so, you know, I did most of the reporting and writing, first draft for 50% of the chapters. Vice versa for Peter. Then we changed them, and you know, each edited the other's work. So it was a very ambitious project.
And you're still married?
Well, we're still on speaking terms, and that's good. Look, it's our third book together. Our first book was about Vladimir Putin, based on the 4 years that we spent as Moscow bureau chiefs for the Post, right at the period when Putin was first coming to power 20 years ago. We just did a biography of the former Secretary of State, Jim Baker, the man who ran Washington. And so this was our, in some ways, our heaviest lift in terms of doing it so quickly. Every book, every presidency, you know, tends to have a book like this. The Lou Cannon did a fantastic job with the Reagan presidency. Our former colleague, John Harris, did it for the Clinton presidency. But, you know, we turned it around pretty quickly, in part because Trump has not left the stage like other modern presidents, but is still, you know, the present tense of American politics.
You're working for different publications, you at the New Yorker, Peter at the New York Times. Are you going to cover the upcoming election? And I mean the midterm, before we get to the presidential.
Absolutely. My job is to write. I write a weekly letter from Washington for the New Yorker. And, you know, that is an all-consuming subject here these days, for sure.
Are you concerned about the nature of the vote count, the way that elections are administered, and all the threats that seem to exist to how it's been done before, including the one coming from the United States Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no question that, you know, the Republican Party in different states led by Trump has turned, you know, essentially sought to politicize what should be the nonpartisan administration of elections around the country. And while it was primarily Republican elected officials who stopped Trump from overturning the election or illegitimately interfering with it after the 2020 election, Republicans like Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, for example, you know, basically Trump has spent the 2 years since then trying to make sure that there are people who are personally loyal to him and who have subscribed to his election denialism in positions to oversee future elections. So I think it's a very grave and serious threat. And I would note that while there have been bipartisan bills in both the House and the Senate to fix some of the vulnerabilities at the national level in the Electoral Count Act that were identified by the attack on the 2020 election from Trump and his allies on January 6th, those bills have not passed Congress, and they've had 2 years to do it. And now Democrats may lose the House or the Senate or both
Okay, once again, the past is prologue. And Susan Glasser, it's wonderful to talk to you. Again, the book is called The Divider. Susan Glasser, with her husband Peter Baker, is author of the book. And again, many, many thanks to you for being with us. Come back and talk to us again.
Great to be with you, Warren. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back with the history of the PG&E, 100 years of history in Northern California, how the utility, America's biggest, has turned into a corporate criminal, which may not be able to keep the lights on in the future. That's on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. California Burning, that's a book about the deadliest corporate crime in American history. It describes the fall of the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, that's the PG&E, taken for granted as it kept the lights on and the economy running for more than 100 years in an area the size of New England. But then there was a massive explosion in a residential neighborhood near San Francisco, and that was followed over the next couple of years by multiple forest fires, the worst in state history. One of the characters in California Burning says that PG&E now stands for Pray to God and Evacuate, and we'll hear what that means for us. The book's author is Catherine Blunt. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she's based her account on a series of prize-winning stories by herself and others that appeared in the paper. She also did a lot of other research, obviously, as well. And Catherine Blunt, welcome to The Point.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
What is the deadliest corporate crime, or what was, in American history?
So in 2018, in November, one of PG&E's high-voltage transmission lines failed and ignited a fire that killed 84 people. And it resulted in an investigation after which the company was indicted on 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter for each of those deaths. And the company agreed to plead guilty.
Agreed to plead guilty. So it is now a felon with a very, very important conviction.
That's right. And in fact, it was the company's second conviction. You mentioned the deadly explosion. And that happened in 2010 in San Bruno, south of San Francisco. As a result of that, the company was convicted on charges of violating the Federal Pipeline Safety Act in the way that it oversaw its gas transmission system.
Were individuals convicted of crimes or the company itself?
It was the company itself. And it's in the book, I try to do a lot to explain what this means. You know, it's the idea of corporate liability, pressing charges against the corporate entity as opposed to any employees within it. It's a really complicated area of the law. And, you know, it's a lot of people find it very frustrating from an accountability standpoint. But, you know, I really try to explain, why it is that this often happens in a company with a company of this size, diffusion of responsibility and other major challenges.
So nobody went to jail.
That's correct. Nobody went to jail.
But the company, give us a little history. It goes back to the Gilded Age, and it's very important to the history of development in California, much admired and respected for generations. Then two bankruptcies in 15 years and a conviction of this kind. What happened?
So it is true. It's a company with a long and storied history. It did a lot to promote economic development at the turn of the 20th century, serve growing cities in which the populations were growing quite quickly, San Francisco among them. It was a company that built some very early infrastructure to harness the hydropower in the Sierra Nevada. And it only ever had one real competitor in its long history, and that was a company called Great Western Power Company. The two companies competed until they merged in 1930. And you know, that merger created the Northern California monopoly that we know today. That company did a lot over the years to promote economic prosperity across the region. But there was another consequence of this, which is that it was actually Great Western that built the infrastructure that failed and ignited the Camp Fire. And over the course of many years, you know, PG&E lost track of that origin story, lost records on the transmission line that failed, and wasn't even really sure the age of some of the components. And it turned out that the specific piece of hardware that failed had been 100 years old, original equipment installed around 1920.
100 years old, and it cost like 21 cents or something?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, it was a hook. It was a hook. And so the wires, high voltage transmission wires, are suspended from strings of insulator discs that are hooked to the arms of their tower with very little tiny pieces of hardware, about the width of a fist in this case. And that hook had been wearing down little by little with every windstorm over the course of 100 years until it broke roughly in half and dropped that live wire. Electricity surged in the wire, spark settled on the dry brush, and within hours, that fire was completely out of control.
And then it turned out, and there were corporate records that showed this, exchanges between people who were doing inspections or who were in charge of inspections and executives as well, that indicated that the necessary inspections just hadn't been done. And no wonder such a tiny hook could last for 100 years and nobody saw it, nobody knew what was going to happen, and it caused this very deadly fire.
That's right. So in the 20 years or so prior to the Camp Fire, the company over time had reduced the frequency and the thoroughness of the of its inspections of those transmission lines in the Sierra foothills in particular. And periodically, perhaps inspectors would walk beneath the line or fly it quickly by helicopter. But it turned out that neither inspection method was sufficient in evaluating the state of these tiny pieces of hardware. And it wasn't just that particular hook that failed. There were other pieces of hardware, other hooks that exhibited similar wear patterns because, they'd been left to hang for decades. And so the company wasn't aware of this specific issue because it hadn't seen it. But in investigating the disaster, the local prosecutors determined that the company did know in general that there were a lot of risks that it wasn't doing enough to address, which is why we ultimately saw these 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter. The idea was that the company had been recklessly negligent in operating this particular infrastructure that it had.
Recklessly negligent, meaning that they knew or should have known what the dangers were.
Right, that's right. Knew that there was serious fire risk and that the infrastructure could contribute to that risk and didn't do enough to mitigate it over time.
Okay, that's electricity. Now, what about the gas explosion in San Bruno in 2010? What are the similarities between that residential explosion that had to do with gas and the forest fires later on?
Yeah, absolutely. So that the investigation after that disaster was very interesting, that the company ultimately went to trial. And in the course of that process, a lot of evidence came out that in the decade prior to the explosion, the company had been doing a lot to cut operations and maintenance expenses. That includes pipeline inspections. And the reason for this, one of the reasons for this, is that utilities like PG&E, they make money on large capital investments in their system. They don't make money on these operations and maintenance expenses, the day-to-day inspections and replacements of tiny parts. They only profit on investments that boost the overall value of the system. So a good financial performer in the utility space is good at minimizing expenses and freeing up money to invest in capital. Theoretically, a company can strike this balance without compromising safety, but PG&E did not strike this balance well. It had been reducing gas pipeline inspection frequency and, even more importantly, the type of inspections that it was doing. So it was it ultimately wasn't able to appropriately evaluate all the risks throughout the system. And then, of course, one of its pipelines exploded. It turned out in the investigation of the Camp Fire that there were similar expense pressures within electric transmission. There was pressure to reduce expenses in the form of inspections so that company's financial performance wouldn't be compromised. And there's a few reasons for this. It gets a little bit more complicated with the Camp Fire, but The parallels are clear. It was expense pressure and reduced inspection frequency and thoroughness.
What about the overall financial environment during which the company seems to have lost track of its requirement to safely provide gas and electricity and focused on making money instead? Was that something that was going on a broader scale at the same time, particularly in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 90s, across the country, you saw interest in deregulating the electricity sector. It's kind of a complicated idea, but basically what it meant was introducing competition in the generation of electricity. So allowing power plant owners to compete to sell their output, as opposed to the historical way of doing it in which utilities simply owned the power plants and didn't compete. As many listeners I'm sure remember, in California, this new competitive market design resulted in the California energy crisis of 2001. It pushed PG&E to seek bankruptcy protection as a result of the debt that it had incurred during the crisis. And the company emerged around 2004, you know, around the same time that you're seeing interest in utilities becoming something other than the sort of, you know, boring investments that they've historically been, you know, performing better for shareholders. And, you know, this seemed particularly appealing for PG&E because it had just been in bankruptcy. It had an interest in, you know, reestablishing itself as a, you know, as a strong financial performer on Wall Street. And it was a supportive environment for this generally. So that's really, I mean, when you begin to see PG&E make a real push to generate more money, and certainly before the explosion, that did come at the expense of gas system inspections and maintenance. And, you know, there's a few other complicated reasons why this happened, but over time, that same dynamic persisted within the electric division.
Now, you said at the outset that PG&E early on didn't have any real competitors except Great Western, although it turned out to be very important because it had built the infrastructure or a lot of it. Then flash forward, and we're talking about deregulating the industry, at least from a financial standpoint, and the Democrats very much got behind that. How did deregulation occur in California? It cost Gray Davis his job as governor, and he was replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
So deregulation, you know, I consider it to be kind of a misnomer because the utilities sort of certainly throughout this whole process remained regulated entities. Deregulation specifically applied to power generators. So in the course of all this, in the late 90s, PG&E and its counterparts in the South, Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric, sold most of their power plants to companies that would own them and compete to sell the output. The idea was that but this competition would create very low wholesale power costs. And then the utilities would sell that power to customers at retail prices higher than the cost of wholesale prices, allowing them to, you know, collect money to pay down certain debts that they had and other obligations. And it turned out that a combination of supply scarcity in the early 2000s, as well as manipulation of the new market, made it so that wholesale power costs skyrocketed well above retail rates, what utilities were allowed to recoup from customers. So as a result, they wound up with a lot of debt. And as I said before, this resulted in PG&E's first bankruptcy. So the consequences of that are twofold. You know, it emerges from bankruptcy very intent on pleasing its shareholders. The other consequence of deregulation is that the utilities, all of them, would never play the same role again in building power plants. And around this time, you know, as part of broader carbon reduction targets, California began setting very ambitious renewable energy goals. It requires the utilities to contract for large amounts of wind and solar power. These are expenses. And wind and solar are among the cheapest forms of generation today. They were not at the time that the company was setting out to do this, PG&E and its peers. So they were the companies collectively were spending billions of dollars in procuring wind and solar costs. And for PG&E, that was one of the factors that resulted in expense pressure over time.
Who did the manipulating of the market that you referred to? And was that Wall Street? Was that when big investors showed up and began getting involved?
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a lot of Wall Street interest in all of this. So there were a lot of companies involved in manipulating the market. There were some of the power generators, you know, the companies that bought these power plants and were competing. There's also kind of a new contingent of players called traders, you know, in the market that were basically their goal was to, you know, buy power, low cost power and trade it among themselves, or, you know, by selling it to the utilities or some form or fashion, making a profit, even though they didn't directly own the power plants themselves. And the largest, or the most prominent, I should say, among the traders was Enron, infamously, as we know. And Enron was highly sophisticated in its means of gaming the market. Certainly other traders had similar strategies, but Enron was probably chief among them and the most sophisticated.
It's fascinating to talk about all this and the financing and the culture that changed over the decades at this company, so extraordinary and so extraordinarily important. But it's easy to get away and lose sight of who the victims were in all of this. Tell us about them. Your book, it reads like a novel. You've got a cast of characters at the beginning. It includes corporate executives and engineers in charge of safety inspections, but also people who were, in fact, made victims. I think most of us don't know when we pay our bills that whatever utility we pay doesn't necessarily even produce the power anymore. It's very different from that. But the consequences of all of this can be horrendous. How many people died, and how many people are now left with financial obligations, and what's happened to them?
For PG&E, the most devastating disasters occurred in 2017 and 2018. In October of 2017, there were a series of wildfires that ignited when tree branches came in contact with its power lines, mostly lower voltage ones near communities, homes, and businesses. And so what happened was there were nearly 20 fires that ignited, killed 22 people. There was another fire that killed another 22 people that there was debate as to whether PG&E caused it or not. But anyway, you know, collectively in the course of these fires, 44 people died in total. And then in even though 22 of those deaths had been directly attributed to PG&E. And then, of course, in November of 2018, the campfire occurred, in which 84 people died. And so not only do you have the deaths, which, of course, were devastating for so many people, given, you know, family ties, but you also had the destruction of thousands of single-family homes and businesses. And as a result of all this, PG&E faced an estimated $30 billion in liability costs. So the company used the bankruptcy process to try to sort through it. It became one of the most complicated bankruptcies, certainly in utility history, possibly in, you know, American history. It was there were so many savvy financial players that got involved, and you know the biggest thing for PG&E in trying to resolve these liability costs is that it had to settle with three major classes of claimants. The first was governmental agencies that had incurred some costs because of the fires, you know, fire suppression costs and other things. That was the first settlement for $1 billion in cash. And then it reached a settlement with insurance companies that, because of the way liability is assigned in California, these insurers had the right to seek compensation for claims that they'd paid to homeowners as a result of these fires. So it was insurance companies as well as hedge funds and other financiers that had actually purchased some of these claims on the secondary market in a very complex manner that would allow them to profit on these particular claims. That resulted in an $11 billion settlement, all in cash. So by the time it came to settle for PG&E to settle with individual fire victims, businesses, you know, those who'd been truly devastated by these fires, it didn't have enough cash to compensate them in full. So it established a trust that was funded half with cash and half with shares in the company. Upon the emergence from bankruptcy, this trust held about 21% of the company. So it can't just simply liquidate these shares for cash to compensate victims. It has to do so slowly over time, because if it were to do so all at once, the share price would fall precipitously. So to answer your question, victims are still waiting on compensation. Many of them are, and it's going to be a long time before they see much of the value of their claim dispersed.
Have they essentially been made shareholders in the PG&E?
Indirectly, but yes. So the value of their compensation is tied to the company's future share price.
Wow. So because of their losses, they're financing what might happen in the future.
They hold a large stake in the company. It's true.
Just extraordinary. And what about the insurance companies and the hedge funds? They made out on this?
Yeah. So there, this was a really contentious point of the case. So if you think, an insurance company pays claims to a homeowner and can seek reimbursement from PG&E for the value of that claim. There were some insurance companies that said, I don't want to wait around for a settlement from PG&E. I want to sell these claims to whoever will buy them. And so they sold them on the secondary market for at a discount, some for as little as 50 cents on the dollar to hedge funds and others who were willing to wait around for settlement. And so some of these financiers really helped shape the settlement as it came together. They said that they would settle for $1 billion, but the stipulation is it had to be all in cash. And this was really upsetting to some of the attorneys and who are representing the victims as well as the victims themselves, because insurance companies and hedge funds are in the business of managing risk, right? But they negotiated the settlement that was devoid of risk. And ultimately, the fire victims were the ones that had the only settlement reached in the whole case that carried substantial risk.
As I said, you got a cast of characters, and the book begins with a cast of characters, and it includes politicians, regulators, members of the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, as well as the kind of people that we've been talking about so far. But there's a lot of blame to go around here, and even Governor Newsom, who wanted to get a settlement done by a certain date and set a date in date certain to have it all completed. Has some responsibility here.
It's true. There's in trying to manage such a complex set of circumstances, there's a lot of blame to go around historically, and also in managing this particular bankruptcy, unforeseen consequences of some of the decisions. So to answer your point about the regulators, yeah, I mean, prior to the fires, the CPUC, the safety division, to put it simply, was understaffed and underfunded, and had difficulty overseeing what PG&E was doing, of course, but also what the other utilities were doing. It's a huge undertaking overseeing utilities in California. And yes, the Newsom administration set a June 30th deadline for PG&E to get approval of its bankruptcy plan. We also wouldn't have access to a wildfire fund that was set up to help the company manage future liability costs. And, in March of 2020, as the race was on to hammer out this plan, the pandemic happened. And it had major consequences for the company's share price, as it did for other companies, and what that would ultimately mean for the victim settlement, since they would be holding so many shares. And so I think that kind of the combination of the difficult deadline in general, combined with that, unforeseen event that had consequences for the value of the company, it just made it so that it was hard to reach a satisfactory resolution for everybody by the deadline. And ultimately, it kind of turned out that it was what it was. It went through because that was the option that was on the table. And that's what could most feasibly get done by June 30th. And so, that, of course, has consequences for victims. And there's a lot of frustration within the victim community that that's how it went down.
I'll bet there is. And you dramatize it very well in the book. So it's fascinating to hear that the PUC was understaffed and underfunded, just like the PG&E, and perhaps for some of the same reasons, the same political reasons, at least, or same financial reasons. But now all this is in the past. And what's going to happen next? I mean, we've got all these utilities now who are in this situation, not just the PG&E, but the others as well. What are the risks that lie ahead, and how well are we managing them, given climate change, which is coming on strong, something that simply wasn't taken into consideration at all by the PG&E or the PUC for many years?
Yeah. And so one really important element of this story is that over the last 10 years or so, PG&E's service territory changed dramatically with these periods of prolonged drought that we're seeing, drought that has been exacerbated by climate change. Tens of millions of trees died, making the consequence of a spark emitted by a power line all much higher than it had been historically, with the sort of fast-moving, devastating fires that we've seen. And you are beginning to see climate risks emerge very acutely in other areas of the country. More severe weather patterns and events that many of which scientists say have been made worse by climate change. And so that means utilities across the country are having to confront new risks. The grid in general, nationwide, is very old and becoming more prone to failure. Layer on top of that these new climate risks, and the utilities have a lot to manage. And I think PG&E's experience shows that if the company has, any company has a history of mismanaging spending or mismanaging risk, is going to be even harder to get ahead of this at a time when we are becoming more reliant on electricity. So maybe, you know, for a utility in the East, power line failure doesn't mean catastrophic wildfire, but it means a days-long power outage. And we are, I mean, that, as I've also seen through PG&E's experience, long power outages jeopardize a lot of things. It major economic costs, health costs for those who rely on electricity for medical reasons, and of course, just major, major inconvenience. And so, it's incumbent upon all utilities to be sort of forward thinking in their risk management, but that's not a given for every utility across the country at this point.
And again, Gray Davis was replaced in office in part because of the blackouts that occurred. And they didn't last all that long, several days maybe, but the devastation that that caused was really very widespread. I'm not sure all of us in Southern California realize how serious it was.
Yeah, I mean, so for in the case of Gray Davis, it was the experience of, you know, brief rolling outages that can result from supply-demand imbalance on the grid. You know, of course, we've been, you know, we did a flex alert statewide, of course, for almost a week straight, just very recently, for these very reasons. But in 2019, after the catastrophic wildfires that PG&E experienced, one thing that it started to do was to preemptively turn off the power at risky times, you know, when it felt as though there was a great risk of its equipment failing somehow. And most famously, in October of 2019, the company turned off the power to millions of people for days on end, 3 or 4 days in some cases. And it was extremely concerning for Newsom, you know, remembering what had happened to Gray Davis and knowing what a political liability that would like very likely become. And of course, you know, he managed to weather it, but it was, it was an enormous challenge for the state. Major, major economic losses, millions of angry customers. It was a total disaster.
And that's one of the reasons that he advocated the retention or extension of the power plant at Diablo Canyon, the nuclear plant, on the grounds that it would help to alleviate the problems that might occur in the future. And those problems could be enormous. What about the efforts to make things better? One of the things that's been talked about is burying the power lines, but there's hundreds of miles of those things.
Right, right. So the company's strategy currently is they say that they are going to bury 10,000 miles of power lines.
Oof.
It could really do a lot to change the risk profile of the territory because if the line is underground, it can't start a fire. But the estimate at this point is that it will cost $20 billion. Of course, we know that rates in California for electricity are already very high. We're living in an inflationary environment in which it's becoming more expensive to produce power. I think the biggest challenge here, of course, is cost management, figuring out how much customers can reasonably be expected to pay in this endeavor, how that cost can be managed over time, whether there's, you know, sort of different mechanisms than just simply collecting it in a few short years here as they're trying to, you know, accelerate this work. And, you know, there's labor challenges and engineering challenges too. So, you know, theoretically, it certainly makes a lot of sense, but it remains to be seen how the company can manage through some of these challenges in the near term here.
Of course, this is a worldwide problem. We've got the impact of the war in Ukraine. We've got reduction of gas from Russia into Europe and all of that. And you said that, of course, at the same time, in part in response to climate change, we're getting more and more dependent on electricity rather than less and less. Have you talked to people about the possibility that we're all simply going to have to reduce our own personal electrical usage or find other ways to generate electricity on our houses or in our cars or whatever in order to try to avoid the kind of consequences you just described?
So I think that, you know, in some ways, the system that we have in which investor-owned utilities provide most of the power nationwide, I mean, I think that that system is in place for the foreseeable future. And part of the solution is going to be, you know, finding ways to make that more workable, whether that be tighter regulatory oversight, other things. But I mean, to your point, there's also more distributed generation technology, rooftop solar panels paired with batteries, microgrids, other things that could help alleviate some of these challenges of delivering power over long distances and, you know, the kind of the expense that comes with managing the centralized system. I don't think that there's sort of I think that there's a lot of things that will sort of change incrementally that will help small ways to redesign parts of the system. But unfortunately, there's really no easy solution. And to your point about this being a global problem, I mean, just the exposure to the global market forces that we're seeing probably make it so that we are entering a period in which energy in general is going to cost more. For much of the last couple of decades, it was relatively cheap for a number of reasons. And it seems that the dynamics have changed to the point where that's no longer going to be the case for as long as we can sort of see into the future.
All right. Once again, the book is California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric and What It Means for America's Power Grid. And it has implications that go well beyond that, as you've just heard as well. Again, it's a fascinating read. As I said, it reads like a novel, even though it involves some sort of mind-boggling complexities from time to time. You managed to write around them, Catherine Blunt, in an extraordinarily good way, an interesting way, and you keep it moving. Again, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for the book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody, with assistance from Anna Buss. Our engineer is John Meek. I'm Warren Olney. Thanks again for listening. Join us again.